Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and is Max Verstappen's continued brilliance undervalued? Could Mercedes be losing faith in George Russell? What's up with Oscar Piastri? And is it time for F1 to intervene to shake up the order? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to tackle these listener questions and many more are Mark Hughes and Glenn Freeman. Glenn, welcome back. Another batch of questions. These are always fun. This midweek post-race podcast with listeners' questions from the Race Members Club is becoming quite a nice tradition, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the reason it exists is because we're getting so many questions now. You guys have been answering them on the post-race podcast for a couple of years now, maybe. And we're just getting more and more and more of them. And they're all so good as well. That's the thing. And I sympathise with you, Ed, trying to work out which ones to pick for the post-race episodes, particularly when we didn't really have a home for the rest of them. So, yeah, this has happened because the quality of the questions we get is so good that it just felt wrong to kind of leave them all on effectively a digital cutting room floor, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little bit easier now because when the big list of questions comes through, it's quite easy to sort between the sort of really, really pressing race-focused ones and the slightly broader ones, although there are a couple of race-specific ones that have carried over for this one. And Mark Hughes, you're always keen on a question. Are you enjoying these podcasts?
Yeah, that's great. It's as Glenn says, there's high quality of questions, and that always has the effect of engaging you because you have to think about the answer rather than just being able to bat it away and there's the depth of the questions.
Yeah, that is one of the advantages that we do have got a high quality of questions. So thanks very much to everyone who sends them in. If you're interested in joining the Race Members Club, you can click the link in the description of this podcast. You can also head to our website, therace.com. Don't forget the hyphen if you're going there. You can click on Join the Race. And you can also sign up for our members podcast via Apple Podcasts as well. So lots of ways to do that.
Can I just quickly add, while we're talking about how much we love our members, we've just run a survey for them. And just before we came on to record this podcast, I've just had a look at the initial results. So I want to say a massive thank you to all of our existing members. Firstly, for your great questions that we're about to pile into, but also to those of you who filled out the survey. We did one last year and it helped us sort of change our strategy and work out what to prioritise. That's going to happen again. You know, we're just going to keep evolving this and giving these people more of what they want because we love their support and we love getting the feedback from them as well. So yeah, just massively grateful to everyone who filled out the survey. Your answers were really useful and I promise you will see some positive changes as a result of what you've told us.
Excellent. There's some things to look forward to there. And I've got no idea what the survey told us. So I'm quite looking forward to finding out the new directions as well. So that's a conversation for us to have after the podcast. Well, let's get on to our questions now. First up from Edwin Have. Mark, we'll aim this one at you. Looking at Sergio Perez and the other drivers' performances, it seems they're a bit closer to Max Verstappen in qualifying. However, it seems Max is unlocking more and more performance as the season progresses, as he gradually understands the car better and sets it up to his liking. Would you think that's one of his core qualities, and that in three or four races from now, the gap between Max and others, and in particular with Sergio Perez, will become even bigger again?
Yeah, I think you've hit on an interesting trend there that we've seen also in 22 and 23. I think as the design evolves from one season to the next, it takes a few races for Max and his race engineer GP to fully get all the little nuances of a car. These cars are invariably highly sophisticated, and what worked on one won't necessarily be exactly the same on the next one. They've got different sensitivities. So yeah, as they go along, there tends to be a higher ceiling for Max to find. And it was like that, as I say, in the previous 2 years as well. But whether Perez will get left behind in that process this time or develop with him, that really depends on how he and his engineer, Hugh Bird, crack the code. Because that code's different for each driver. And typically, Max will develop it further towards more front end and always find a way of making that work with the rest of the car, because that allows him a higher ceiling of his own performance. Perez's ceiling's not as high as that, but there's nothing to say he won't progress as well, but in his own direction. When he tries to follow Max's direction, it's counterproductive. He can't drive it like that. But the problem for Perez or any driver when paired with someone really fast like this who likes a lot of front end of the car, it typically comes when the team has to make choices on development directions. And what we've been talking about so far is just like choice setup choices made by the driver and his engineer. But when you're finding a direction to go to develop the car, you can be led by that. And over time, that will invariably follow the faster driver. And Red Bull is in the past, back in 2020, gone too far in that direction and had to reverse out of it because, you know, you made a car that Max was incredibly fast in, but the car itself wasn't that quick, and his teammates were getting further and further left behind because the car was actually becoming worse for them. And they had to reverse out of it. So I think that was a valuable lesson learned, and they know where that threshold is now, I think. So I don't see that repeating. But yeah, that process that you mentioned is, I think, a very valid one.
We used to see it in Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes peak years, didn't we? I always felt that Bottas was closer to Hamilton at the start of the year, and then Lewis would do what Max does, where he kind of just keeps finding more and more from the car, and then the number two sort of teammate gets left a bit behind as the year goes on.
Yeah, and I think as alluded to there, it's not completely unique to Verstappen. It's a thing that you see absolutely great drivers do. There's not many of them, but they always are brilliant at just finding these little extra gains. Another question on Verstappen for you, Glenn, from Thomas Knight, who asks, is Max Verstappen's continued brilliance underrated and undervalued by fans more so than journalists? In China, he looked completely in control, yet was nowhere in the driver of the day voting.
Yeah, I think there's a distinction here between perhaps undervalued or underrated and taken for granted. I think eventually you get to a point, if you're at Max's level, of such sustained brilliance that because it's expected of you, it doesn't get people's attention in the same way. It doesn't impress people on a weekly basis in the same way. They know it's there, but they perhaps feel sort of less need to acknowledge it each time with, say, a Driver of the Day vote. Looking at Driver of the Day itself, it could also be that fans look at it as a way to reward someone else who maybe isn't getting the recognition or the spoils of victory itself. It could even be that fans of other drivers are perhaps more determined to vote for their guy than Verstappen fans are, because they're just happy because Max is winning all the time. So they maybe don't have the same motivation. I feel like it's part of the reason Driver of the Day is there, is that it's not necessarily just to say the guy who won, who's on top of the podium already and has the biggest trophy, here's another accolade for him. I think I always felt the intention of it was kind of to shine a light on someone else's good performance. So I guess in that respect, it is kind of doing what it should.
Do we get Nikita Mazepin winning it once when the first time it was held, or somebody unlikely because there was a sort of a mass campaign among their fans? It sort of got corrupted a little bit at first, but it seems to have evened out now.
There's always a risk of that with those sorts of votes. But yeah, it's just a probably a symptom of Max Verstappen doing extraordinary things all the time, and they cease to become extraordinary because, of course, that's just what he does.
Yeah, he normalises it.
Well, exactly. And in fact, that connects to the next question, which I'll take, which is from Mark Andrews, who says, is it time to start talking about Max being one of, if not the best, qualifier on the grid? We talk about Charles Leclerc being number one, and even though Max has the best race car, it's not always the best in quali trim, yet at the end of Q3, Max is consistently at the front of the grid. Yeah, Max is an outstanding qualifier, no question. And yeah, there are a lot of times when things are a bit trickier in qualifying because the car doesn't have that advantage in qualifying and you have to sort of thread the needle, get the tyres right, etc. And he's superb at that, as well as being blindingly quick. It's an interesting thing because you can certainly make a case for Leclerc being the quickest driver over a single lap in F1, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's the best at putting it together in qualifying, which is one of the things he's been struggling with. So Verstappen's outstanding in so many ways. I would actually say, though, that if your listing is outstanding qualities, qualifying's not right at the top, because actually I'd argue his race performance is the relentless pace, the control of the pace, the way he executes it. All of these things are outstanding about him. But yeah, he is, you know, you can make a very strong case that he's the best qualifier on the grid. He's certainly right up there, but there's no aspect of his game where he's not right up there ultimately. And maybe we just end up taking that for granted because there's only so many times you can say how brilliant he is, because he quite clearly is. Mark, a question for you from Jeremy Husted now, who says, are George Russell's inconsistent form and multiple errors starting to erode Mercedes' faith in him, hence elevating Kimi Antonelli to Hamilton's heir apparent? Also, is Toto Wolff delusional to think that Max Verstappen would go to that mess of a team, or is this just all posturing to try and save face?
Some leading questions there, Jeremy.
Walk straight into it. Go on.
Inconsistent form. Actually, all I'm seeing is an inconsistent car, as both Hamilton and Russell swinging wildly as they try to make sense of it, sort of trying in vain to find a sweet spot or stay in. Multiple errors. He got caught out by the Alonso's extreme braking and accelerating sequence on the last lap in Melbourne. But the last mistake, really, the big mistake, I guess, was last lap of Singapore last year. So I think it's a bit of an unfair assessment of Russell, and I don't think it's one shared at all by Mercedes. Antonelli is potentially coming in because they've got enormous belief in this potential. And if they are focusing on the new PU rigs, giving them an opportunity of a full return to competitiveness in 26, then you might say 25 could be his learning year with nothing very much at stake. But I think they'd be bringing him on board regardless if he was in the other car. But if the situation arose whereby they could get Verstappen, then obviously Antonelli would have to get his F1 experience elsewhere, probably at Williams. Would Max come? I don't believe he'll, not in 25 anyway. But for 26, you know, we don't know what's going on, really. We hear, you know, it's assumed that Red Bull Powertrains isn't on top of the new regulations because it's their first attempt at it, and that Mercedes will be brilliant at it because it was the last time with it was a different engine formula. But I don't think we can assume those things to be the case just yet. And so by this, you know, latter part of 25, let's say, there should be a few more indications, a few more readings for Max, if he really is interested in trying his hand at a different team. So I don't think you could look at the current form as an accurate barometer necessarily of where they're going to be, you know, almost 2 years from now. So yeah, it's a little bit of a shambles at the moment as they're trying to work out what's going wrong. But I don't think you can assume that it will always be like that.
I would I'll pick up on the very final part of the question that was about posturing to try and save face. I think Toto needs to back off on the Max Verstappen talk now. I think he's making himself look a bit silly. Yes, there are, and I'm sure you guys are having these conversations as well, there are Dutch sources close to the Verstappens who still think this truce at Red Bull is an uneasy one. But if Toto really thinks there's something going on that he can use to pry Max out of, let's remember, a contract that runs to 2028, is it? Mm. If he thinks that there's an opportunity for that, this isn't the way to do it. And at the very least, this should be combined with a proper serious effort behind the scenes to see what you can do. But I would take it all behind the scenes now, because I think it's just, I assume Toto's responding to questions that he's asked about it, but he could say less. I know Christian Horner got very upset or fired back at him, should we say, in China. And I can see why. If this is all just a bit of fun and games because Mercedes have nothing positive to talk about with their own car, I don't think it's working. It's not tricking any of us into not noticing how bad that car is. So I think, maybe a revised strategy is needed. I don't need to see any more quotes from Toto that appear to be poking the Red Bull Verstappen bear, personally.
Yeah, I certainly don't read it as posturing to save face. I think it's just fishing almost. There's obviously, because if there was lots of dialogue going on.
I'm not
on,
sure he's got much bait on the hook, though.
Not massively, no. And I think you'd probably admit that as well if pushed on it. But I think if there was lots of dialogue going on in the background, he wouldn't be quite so full on. I think it's just planting the idea. Come on, you know, it's not just about how good the car is now. Hinting about 26. You know, does a driver need a new challenge? That kind of thing. So I think it's done in hope more than expectation, and I guess worth a try. But yeah, there is a point where it risks becoming a bit repetitive. And a question from Yannis van der Waal, which we'll all have a go at because it's a prediction, and that's always a difficult one. It's a matter not of if, but when Max Verstappen becomes world champion. Would you dare to make a prediction of when? So does anyone have a race in mind?
I'm going for Qatar sprint race again.
that late?
Yeah, I think Perez will score consistently high enough to keep it mathematically open. Since the season started in Bahrain and between there and the Qatar sprint, I think everybody knows who the champion's going to be, which is fine. That's just how good a job Red Bull has done and how good Verstappen is. But it would be great if the others could get better. But yeah, I think... He'll be able to keep it open as long as he did last year, Perez I'm talking about. I'll go there again. There's something quite amusing by it being clinched in such an underwhelming way in a Saturday sprint.
Yeah, all I did was look at how far before the end of the season he won it the last 2 years. And based on that, I'm going to say that this time, obviously slightly longer season. I don't know. I reckon sort of USA, Mexico time. So what's that? Late October, mid-late October?
Yeah, I was going to go for Austin as well, which is round 19 on the 20th of October. There's not much science behind that, but it's a bit like last year. But I think the important thing is, it really is a matter of when rather than if. So it's kind of by the by. But yeah, if it gets done in a sprint race, that's good value. Is Austin a sprint race this year? I think it is again, isn't it? I lose track. So that's a good way to do it in slightly underwhelming fashion.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done, and Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done. Well, we've had five questions relating to Oscar Piastri, which I'll combine into one, given they all overlap to a certain extent, but they combine to tee up quite a good discussion on the McLaren driver's progress. And Gareth asked about how Piastri is stacking up against Norris in terms of pace and racecraft. Andy MF asked if Piastri's progress has flattened this season. Simon Toms also referred to that and asked if the Piastri hype train is slowing, with JK asking about what he calls recent stagnation from Piastri. And Kieran Lister asked for an explanation of where Piastri has a deficit to Norris and to Race's Year. And Jesper Pendlebury pointed out that Piastri was struggling for pace even before Stroll decided that Australians don't deserve a functioning diffuser in China and asked what's going on. So Mark, lots to discuss there, but what's your overview of Piastri's start to the season, and is there any sense of disappointment?
A little bit, yeah. He was so outstanding at his peak last year. There's a lot of precedent for difficult sophomore years after sparkling rookie seasons. It's as if the brain's busy unscrambling everything that it's learned subconsciously in a hurry. But you know, with a rookie, the peaks you see are the real potential. So it's not the averages. So you will see quiet weekends. And it was like that last year with Piastri on occasion. And it's evidently still like this. But there was this expectation that he'd be able to deliver big every time he got in the car this year. And it would have been great if he had. But it's a bit more complex than that with these tyres. And experience, it really does matter when there's not much testing. And like last weekend, for example, a sprint weekend on a track he's never seen before is a very harsh test. So, yeah, I do think it's just data and miles. At his best, the aero balance he can live with the car all in the front. It's pinned on the nose at crazy high speeds. It's like Max or Schumacher before him, way more than Norris in terms of how he has the car. But it's not as instant a translation of that potential as some. You know, anyone who can do some of the fast corner speeds we've seen him doing at his best is going to turn out to be incredible when it all comes together. Nobody who can do what he's done, you know, when you look at it in detail, has ever not turned out to be a megastar. But everyone's wired up differently, so I guess it'll take as long as it takes, but yeah, it's been a little bit underwhelming in the first few races.
I think it illustrates, as you alluded to there, the challenge of when you're up against someone like Norris as well. Going into the second year, small things can make a big difference. There has a number of races been a bit of a deficit, but then that tends to multiply, doesn't it? Whether it's you've got to slightly compromise your strategy because of the way other cars are and having to respond to undercut threats or be proactive in that regard. So I feel like sort of Piastri's close when he hasn't been ahead. He was ahead in Saudi Arabia. But yeah, sometimes that gap gets slightly exaggerated. Maybe China was that there was a reasonably clear pace difference. But yeah, I think Piastri's got a lot of ability and it will certainly come. I'm sure Piastri himself is slightly disappointed. Are you getting excited about Piastri, Gunn?
Well, the back end of last year was what made me excited about him. And what I mean is, that was when I felt that the hype from his junior career was being delivered on. You know, the reason there was so much fuss and so much fighting about getting him into F1 was because he looked so good as a junior prospect. And then it's so hard now, I think, for rookies to come in and make that instant impression because they're learning on the job more than they've ever had to before. So it was the way his momentum built that I liked. And I think that is partly what was the motivation for some of the questions we had there, where almost he ended last year so on such a roll, it seemed, and just with a few key things that he needed to improve. And I guess a lot of people had really high expectations for the start of this year, and that's what's fueled the questions. But as Mark's explained there, you know, we're not at a point here where you're going, oh, okay, so the back end of last year was a flash in the pan and this is his real level.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot more to come. He won't want to go through this season being the second McLaren driver four times out of five, as has been the case across the five weekends. But I suspect that will change. Glenn, a question from Sean O'Connor. who says it definitely seems Lance Stroll isn't helping Aston Martin in the Constructors' Championship. Given his dad runs the team, it also seems that he has an F1 seat for as long as he wants. However, his dad isn't the only investor in the team. Can you see a situation where the co-investors, or sponsors for that matter, get frustrated with the team's results and force Lawrence's hand?
I'd be surprised if they force his hand. I think Lawrence Stroll gives off an air of, you know, the man who has all the power and the sway there. But you do have to wonder if any of these partners or co-investors might quietly ask the question at some point, particularly if Aston end up losing out on a championship position, which at the moment you'd say could be to Mercedes because of Lance's underperformance, because then you're costing the team income. So, you know, there's a tangible knock-on effect there rather than just the prestige of a sort of middling championship position. My suspicion is that Lance is there for as long as he or his dad wants him to be. But this question motivated me to do some maths that I've been waiting to do, or I've thought of doing for the last couple of weekends, which is Stroll versus his teammates since he moved to this team. So it was Racing Point initially and then Aston Martin. So he was teammate to Sergio Perez for 2 years and was outscored 177 points to 96 across those two seasons. And let's not forget, Perez was fourth in the championship in 2020 with the pink Mercedes, the copycat car. Obviously looked out better against Sebastian Vettel in 21 and 22. Vettel still outscored him 80 to 52, though. And I think we all agree that wasn't the Sebastian Vettel of old. And then, of course, he's been demolished by Fernando Alonso. 2023 and a few races in 2024, 237 points to 83. So there's a consistent pattern here. Whoever you put in the other car, and, you know, Alonso, Vettel and Perez, all pretty established, pretty well-respected drivers. And the reason I say well-respected is, like I say, Vettel wasn't the winning machine that we'd seen earlier in his career, but he's still Sebastian Vettel. Would any other driver, as a second driver in a team, be able to be constantly beaten by his teammates in that way and keep that seat? You know, Valtteri Bottas was in one of the second leading cars. If Valtteri Bottas had had a bunch of teammates like this and they'd all beaten him that convincingly in a midfield car. We're talking about Piastri just now. If Oscar Piastri had a record like that across his first sort of 5 or 6 years at McLaren against a couple of different teammates, none of those guys are keeping their seat. So you really feel like in terms of public pressure, there is a building mass of it now. It just doesn't strike me that Lawrence Stroll is the sort of person to be bothered by that.
Yeah, I think you'll take the approach that it's his money, his team, and you'll keep going with that and keep Lance in the car. That seems to be the way it's going. Certainly not expecting any change for next year. Question now from C. Ebert, who says, what happens to Bottas if he doesn't land a Sauber spot? He's underwhelmed in his time there, as Joe has been much closer than he should be. Does he swap with Hülkenberg at Haas? I think Bottas's hopes of remaining at Sauber depend on nobody else wanting to go there. I'm pretty sure that Sauber decided they want a clean sweep, change two drivers. If they were to keep one, I suspect it would be Bottas, because he has been the stronger of late pretty consistently. In fact, actually, he's had a pretty good season this year, I think, Bottas, particularly in terms of his pace. He'd have scored a few points, as we've talked about at length in our various race reviews. So I think Bottas has got a fighting chance of getting a place elsewhere. I don't think it's absolutely guaranteed, but Haas could be interested in a driver like that. They need a driver with experience. So if Hülkenberg were to move, they could keep Magnussen maybe, or they might decide to drop him and take a driver like Bottas. There's any number of other places that could open up for Bottas, Alpine, a return to Williams, that kind of thing, maybe. But I think probably for Bottas to do that, he needs to keep performing well, which he's doing. And maybe he might have to revise his pay expectations, because he's on the deal with Sauber that was when he was a front-running driver with Mercedes, a multiple Grand Prix winner. Obviously, he's still that, but he's moving not from the leading team in Formula One, but from a team that's been struggling. So his value has reduced a little bit. But I think he's a driver who's got the qualities that will have a decent chance of finding a place if, as we expect, he doesn't stay on at Sauber. And if nobody wants to go there, maybe he will get another year there. Mark, a question from Eric Shutton, who says, so far, Sauber has been disappointing this year. The pace of the new car seems average at best. Pit stops are generally poor. And Bottas retired from the Chinese Grand Prix. How worried is Audi? And are there signs of panic in the paddock?
Yeah, the cars aren't great, but it's a lot better than the results have made it look. It's not so far off the RB, which is, you know, the leader of best of the rest after the top five teams. It's about on a par with the Haas, but with the wheel issue, it's defined these slow pit stops, and they're stuck with that until Imola, I believe. No signs of panic as such, but there's a few onlookers wondering why Audi hasn't been more proactive in getting the big investments made sooner. It's beginning to come now. But that's just part of this slightly unusual progressive ownership change, I guess, whereby the Audi stake is growing season by season until it's, the full-on owner. But, it's a little bit in a holding pattern in its current guise. It's sort of halfway in between Sauber and Audi, isn't it? So I don't think there's any particular panic, but at the same time, you don't really progress without a lot of ambition and a lot of drive. So, that's what we're looking for from them as time goes on.
I really hope that Audi have their eyes open to how long it's going to take to turn this team into what Audi will want it to be. And I hope they've got the stomach and the patience for the long journey. If obviously things could change in 2026, the competitive order could change. But if we were looking at F1 as it is now, I would say getting Sauber to the point where it could latch on to that back of that top five teams, even that's going to take a long time to be doing that consistently. And Audi need to realise that. I think it's brilliant that they're coming in. They're one of those great manufacturers that's done brilliant things all over motorsport, but didn't have any F1 pedigree or achievements to their name. So I really want them to have their eyes open to how long it's going to take and how expensive it's really going to be. I think any manufacturer or team has an idea when they commit to the program, they think, okay, we can do F1 for X amount of hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever. And I think they'd all tell you it ends up costing a lot more once you get there. And I hope Audi are aware of that and ready to put up with that. I just said, obviously, they've got no F1 history. That worries me a little in the sense that I don't think it would take as much at board level or, you know, total upper management level for someone to come in, someone new to be put in charge after a few years, say 2 or 3 years, and go, why are we spending all this money to be the 6th or 7th best team in F1? And there'll be people involved in the team, probably people like Andreas Seidel, going, well, yeah, this is all part of, you know, you need 5 years, you need 10 years. It's a long time now to turn around an F1 team, even with massive investment. I mean, look at Aston Martin, a lot of money being spent there, not yet manufacturer involvement, but it's a sign of how long it can take. And Racing Point, was a better base point, I'd say, performance-wise than Sauber is. So Audi, I love that you're coming in. Please, please be patient, because this is going to be a long journey.
Yeah, if anything, I wonder if there's almost not enough, not the words, not panic, but not enough urgency. There's a bit of a concern that maybe they think, well, we become Audi in 26 and everything will be great then, whereas I want to see that team wringing absolutely everything out of what it's got right now, because all that culture and that drive and that delivery and performance, even if you're doing it down the grid, that's all being sharpened right now, or at least that's what I want to see happening, so they can be as strong as they need to be by 26. Because if you sit around waiting for a couple of years for this point to happen, you risk turning into Alpine and everything's always a few years in the future and that future never quite comes. Right, Glenn, a question from James and Shelley Lee. With Lando Norris claiming his 15th career podium this weekend, when and where does the pod think he has his best chance this season of claiming that elusive maiden victory? We'll let you have a punt at that race.
Yeah, this season. So firstly, I guess he needs another race where Max Verstappen retires. And then it has to be a weekend where Perez isn't doing a good enough job as the backup. So we've narrowed our options already. Then he obviously needs McLaren to keep improving so that they are at the front of the queue when that happens. So that, you know, the next time Max isn't around to win a race, it's not Ferrari, or should I say Carlos Sainz, picking up the pieces again. I'm sure what the question really meant was, which tracks will McLaren be most competitive at? I'll throw that back to you two. Are we looking at places like Silverstone and Qatar again? They were the ones that stood out to me sort of last year from McLaren.
Yeah, those traits are still there. It's still very, very good in a fast corner. It still struggles in slow corners, especially long slow corners. So, I would think that's not a bad shout, Glenn.
Yeah, but I think the point is it's not going to be on outright merit. It's going to be one where Verstappen is delayed, unfortunately. But if you keep finishing on the podium, you will eventually win one. I think 15 is the highest number anyone's got to of podiums in World Championship races without then going on to winning one. I think certainly Eddie Irvine got to 15 from memory, whereas, of course, the outright record now is Norris is on 15, but I suspect he'll lose that eventually. But anyway, a little bit of a statistical diversion there. Right, a question from Chris and Gandu now that I'll take, who says, are Esteban Ocon's strong drives this season maybe giving him a chance at jumping up the order at Audi? I think he's in reasonable contention on the Audi shortlist. He might need Carlos Sainz not to decide to go there, but yeah, Ocon's doing a good job at Alpine. He's out of contract and he's talking to plenty of teams. I think it's going to be one of the back half of the grid teams that Ocon would end up at. So yeah, it's certainly possible. He's a driver that Andreas Seidel quite likes, so he's certainly in the mix, and from the start of the season it's been clear he's been one of the, say, top four choices there. And yeah, doing the job on track will always put you in a better position, but he'll have to decide whether he really wants to push for a new Alpine deal and continue the work that he's been doing there for years or jump somewhere else. I have to admit, I think maybe you'd be very tempted to take the Audi offer if it were on the table, but I think he'll have to wait before that eventuality happens. I think he maybe needs Carlos Sainz to turn them down before that becomes a strong possibility. Mark, a question from Jack Aitken now. He says, personally, I'm a huge fan of the new sandpit-style gravel trap at the final corner in China. There's still some jeopardy for any driver looking to push their luck, but also plenty of runoff beyond that. Could this compromise be the future of circuit design?
Totally with you on that, Jack. That's the ideal, rather than white lines. A bit of grass, then gravel, would be even better, because the grass and the dry, at least, it's sort of get out of jail, not free card, but get out of jail by paying a heavy fine and lap time card. I'm all for it. It's not feasible on every single corner on the calendar, of course, because there are all sorts of physical constraints, but I think it should be applied wherever it's feasible so you can forget track limits at those corners. It might mean a few more stoppages and red flags, though. That would be the downside. But in terms of driver challenge, yeah, this is how it should be.
Yeah, I would say you don't need much gravel the other side of the curb to act as a real deterrent. And it might be that the smaller the area of gravel is, obviously this was a proper gravel track, but a small one might cause less trouble for these circuits the rest of the year round. This is always the thing that I get to with track limits, when people say, just put gravel everywhere. Gravel traps are expensive to install for circuits and difficult and expensive to maintain. Plus, the rest of the year round, when the F1 circus isn't at these tracks, there's all sorts of other series racing and testing at these circuits. All three of us here have been club racers in our time. We've been at test days. We've been at track days where if you go to a circuit lined with gravel traps everywhere, okay, good for keeping you within track limits. But every time someone has an off, as we've said, okay, we might get some more stoppages in F1 weekends. That's kind of fine. But when people like us, normal people, are paying to do their racing and testing, you can lose a whole load of track time because people keep going off and getting stuck in gravel traps, and at a club race, the recovery operation isn't going to be as quick as possible. This all might sound irrelevant to F1 fans, but these circuits have to operate, have to function, have to prosper for the other 49, 50 weeks of the year when F1's not around and the gaze of the F1 world isn't around. But it feels to me like a strip of gravel might be a solution, because if you properly go off on the corner, you're not going to get stuck in it. You'll be the other side of it in the asphalt runoff. Great. Then you can rejoin and not cause too much of a problem. And because it's a smaller area, I'd hope it would be cheaper to install and to maintain. So I would hope that this could be a solution. I would still say that at some really high speed corners, you might not want the kind of multiple surface changes of a curb, then a bit of grass, then a bit of gravel, then asphalt, because, you know, with the best will in the world, there's going to be some element of unevenness there, and that's when you can sort of have cars taking off if they hit it at the wrong angle. But it's a, yeah, I agree with Mark. I think I'd love to see a lot more of this. Track limits, I do think it's an important thing to enforce, but I would much rather it was enforced this way than by cameras and people looking at white lines.
Yeah, natural track limits have a lot to be said for them. A question from Oliver Dale, I'll throw at you now, Glenn. Can you explain a little bit more about the reinstating of lap times as happened for Lando Norris during the weekend's qualifying sessions? It feels like the kind of mistake a global sport such as Formula One shouldn't be making, and it makes it all look a little amateur hour.
Well, how often do we say that about F1 officialdom? But to answer the question directly, I'm going to steal a bit of Scott Mitchell Malm's homework here. He did a really good explainer on the Norris situation on the race website at the weekend. At some tracks, it's in the event notes from the race director that if you go off at the final corner or outside of track limits, your next lap is deleted because you've gained an advantage by coming onto the straight in an illegal way. So you're travelling faster. I think of places like maybe the Red Bull Ring or Silverstone. You know, you could get a real good slingshot out onto the start-finish straight just by running too wide out of the final corner. So I think there is that's a worthy system, but it wasn't in the notes in China, was it? And I think at the time Scott wrote his piece, it wasn't clear if that was because of the gravel trap or it was just an oversight. So when the lap was taken away, I'm assuming they either realised that actually that wasn't the policy for this weekend, or they realised that Norris was in fact travelling slower down the straight because he'd been off. I would also just quickly add that I found it hilarious that drivers were losing laps in that wet, damp session for things like going straight on at hairpins or miles off the track. And you'd have a guy, you'd see him lock up. Was it turn six is the first hairpin on the lap? Someone locks up, heads off into the car park runoff area, rejoins with a lap that's clearly been abandoned. They cross the line 15, 20 seconds down on what they could have done. And then you get the notification, lap time deleted. And I'm thinking, yeah, I bet they're devastated about that. A lap that they gave up on has been taken away. I guess it's, you know, we say we want consistency and you need a consistent system. But I thought that was a little bit needless. You know, the driver's given up on the lap. It doesn't really matter if you take it away or not at that point.
Yeah, I think the thing was, it wasn't a mistake as such. It was, I think people assumed it's in the rules. It's not in the rules. It's circuit by circuit, and it depends on how you how the layout allows you to do it. So, yeah, and as you said, he was slower down the straight at the beginning of that lap than he had been previously.
The next question comes from James Pascalis, who asks, why did the race director wait 1.5 laps to put out the virtual safety car for a car in the firing line, then wait another 2 laps to put out the full safety car? Well, I'm not sure it was quite as long as 1.5 laps to put out the VSC, but it was certainly a long time.
It was too long.
It was too long. The race control explanation, which I did check on, was that they had double-waved yellows out, and I think they extended the double-waved yellows a little bit further back, and I think that was maybe a single yellow going into that zone as well. So they were doing that while they were evaluating how easy it would be to recover, and I think it was decided, okay, we can do it under VSC. So then the VSC was thrown, and then when it became apparent that the rear wheels were locked, they were pressing the neutral button, but it wasn't working. That was just one of those things. So I assume it was related to whatever engine-related failure they had, just locked the wheels. So they had to send a recovery vehicle on. And usually when a recovery vehicle enters the track, they do deploy the safety car. They don't absolutely have to. Sometimes you get it just edging on and then just lifting a car or something. But in that situation, they would always safety car it. So the VSC to SC, I've no problem with. I think that's a perfectly reasonable process. They would have moved it under VSC if the neutral button had worked. Yeah, I did think the VSC was a little bit long because I do have a bit of a problem generally with the way double wave yellows are treated. You don't have to back out a huge amount. And if someone had had some kind of weird massive failure, then Bottas's car and Bottas himself were in the firing line a little bit. So yeah, that was their mindset and their thinking. So yeah, I'd maybe have preferred it if it was a little bit quicker to go to go from yellow to VSC. But yeah, VSC to safety car, understandable.
Yeah, I thought this was really bad. I know that the camera foreshortens the distance between Bottas and the track. He's a long way. He's as far into that runoff area as he can get without going into the gravel. But as you say, Ed, he's still dead straight on from the cars that are approaching on the racing line. No one's going to make a mistake that sends them out there. But as you said, you can have a car failure. Something can go wrong that sends your car heading straight on at that corner. There's a reason that runoff is that big. It's because at some point when that circuit has been homologated, it's been decided that it needs to be that big because someone might go off there. Like you, I thought the whole point of VSC was to get us to that point where if you need to recover a car like that, neutralize the field, so then you can send marshals on. And if you need to escalate it from there, fine. I have no problem with if they'd tried and tried and tried under VSC. I just wish they'd gone to VSC sooner. Because once you've got Bottas out of the car, he stood next to it trying to do it himself as well. And it's still double waved yellows at that point. I couldn't believe that. People obviously were saying, was it a reluctance to influence, race strategy? Some people were going further than that and feeling that their driver, whoever that may be, got shafted by it not coming out sooner so they couldn't get a cheap pit stop. I doubt that's an issue. I hope that's not an issue. And the double waved yellows thing, I know it's written as slow down and be prepared to stop. Anyone who's raced at any level knows that there's a difference between being prepared to stop or believing that your reactions will enable you to stop if necessary and actually driving at a slow enough speed where you could quite quickly come to a stop. We could go back and watch all the onboards from the drivers who passed through that double yellow zone. None of them would have been driving at a slow enough speed to say that they were respecting that. That doesn't mean they're breaking the rules. That's just how double waved yellows have been forever. That's why we need a virtual safety car, because unless you set a delta time for the mini sectors under double waved yellows, they're not enough. That they will give the drivers a heightened sense of awareness that something's going on, but they're not going through there at, a walking pace. They're not crawling through this section. So I always think that argument's a bit of a nonsense, really. They took way too long, and it doesn't feel like this is the first time they've taken their time to make that decision, which concerns me.
I just had a quick look while you were talking there, because I was a bit lacking in timing and data information during the race with the internet issues when you're in China. And basically, it's just short of a lap between the yellow flag going out and it going to VSC. And that's measured by, I think, Max Verstappen's basically in turn one when the yellow flag first goes out. And he's sort of making his way up the start-finish straight on the next lap when it turns to VSC. So it's nearest makes no difference a lap before that one happened.
So it was a conspiracy to prevent Max making a pit stop, is what you're saying.
I'm sure there's somebody who's generating that idea. But yeah, I agree with you. I personally would rather have the VSC covering it for the recovery. And in normal circumstances, if you had the VSC, it had been recovered, the neutral button would have worked, they'd have been able to move the car, no problem. But yeah, a slightly strange one, so completely understand that question. Well worth delving into.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Right, a question now for you, Mark, from Mark Martin, who says, while I admit that it would be unfair to penalise a team for brilliance, the predictability of F1 has got a little bit too much for me after 3 years of the same results at the front of the grid. Are there any signs of F1 making short-term changes to mix up the order?
None that are apparent, Mark. I think everyone's got their hopes pinned on the new regs of 26, and whether that hope will play out or not, who knows, but... You know, who's usually been the best in moments of major regulation change, Adrian Newey. But the complication, of course, is that it's power units as well. And power units and fuel chemistry is going to be a massive battleground. In these situations in the past, Bernie Ecclestone as the ringmaster would concoct ways to change the order a little bit. And it happened that way with Liberty in 21 as the low-rake Mercedes was hurt, if you remember. I'm not sure how deliberate that was, but there were... Teams had the suspicions. And that was in the Ross Brawn era, though, and he's retired now. So I don't see anyone quite as calculating and ruthless as Bernie and Ross in playing with the scales. So now I think it's fingers crossed and hoping that the regs are going to do it for them.
It's not the purist's move, is it? But, you know, Mark mentioned the Bernie Ecclestone era there. Two of the best seasons we had in the early 2000s were the 2 years when changes were forced through in an attempt to destabilise Ferrari. They still won the title in 2003, just, and then were properly toppled in 2005 when the tyre rules screwed them. But I think that the 2003 example is a good one because it's not about penalising or unfairly destabilising only Red Bull, because if the goalposts move, there's still every chance that Red Bull does the best job. I don't think anyone's ever going to say that we need genuine performance balancing, or if you're too good, something artificial happens just to you to pull you back. But I can see the argument for making changes that gives everybody a fresh challenge and gives, you know, the chance to shake things up. I can't see it happening for the final year of the regs, even though it did happen in 2021. And what did we get in 2021? A classic season. So, I don't mind being entertained by this sport that I love a bit more.
Next up, a question from Daniel Roberts for you, Glenn, who says, China is round 5 of this year's championship and it will be round 7 in Italy before I can sit down with my family on a Sunday afternoon and enjoy a live race together for the first time this year. Following the announcement of the 2025 calendar, it seems it will be the same next year, possibly leading to further disengagement by European fans. While it's becoming a familiar challenge to avoid all news and internet before watching the recording, is F1 making a mistake by front-loading the calendar with so many flyaway races? Or should I embrace a springtime of F1 induced jet lag?
Great question, Daniel. I say embrace it. This is a global sport. European fans, if anything, were spoiled in years gone by that so many races were in a favourable time zone for us. So let's share the love with the rest of the world. When I was a younger fan, I found a charm about the races being on at funny times. I always enjoyed getting up early or staying up late once in a while. Avoiding spoilers in the modern era is massively tricky. But it's doable, and it's no bad thing to have an excuse to stay off your phone or just mute your notifications for a few hours on a Sunday if needed. I think F1's a global sport. There are some reasons to perhaps mourn the loss of some European circuits or that European core, but I'm sure there's people in other parts of the world who are happy that not every race takes place at 2 o'clock on a Sunday in Europe.
I guess it's the nature of the beast with a world championship, isn't it? I can certainly see why it's frustrating, but yeah, just one of those things about the evolution. A question from Flavio Diomede now, who says, everyone knows and continues to discuss how much better Adrian Newey is at car development. We used to have a competition of geniuses in the past, and I'm thinking of the John Barnard, Gordon Murray, Steve Nichols, among others, time. Newey is a product of that era, having learned with and from the greats, with a great example being the Williams FW14. So given the importance of aero, where are the next Adrian Neweys? To catch up to Red Bull, shouldn't teams be looking to hire the next Newey versus supposedly getting into a bidding war over his service? services. It is surprising to me that there is not the same level of discussion about that type of talent as there is about the next crop of drivers, or are they looking and not finding? And if they can't find that, it would be interesting to discuss why not. Yeah, it's a good point. I think it's slightly different to drivers because drivers ultimately are doing a similar thing. There's a slightly narrower range of what drivers do, whereas design genius is something a little bit different. And I think we've spoken before when we've addressed Newey on this podcast about the time he's from and the unique blend of experience he's got. He's not just an aerodynamicist. He's been a race engineer. He understands vehicle dynamics well, everything about the design of a race car. And I think that's what is so valuable about him, because he's got such a broad hands-on experience and understanding of everything, on top of being, yeah, clearly incredibly intelligent. He is a genius, if you want to use that word. It's difficult to define, but he certainly is brilliant, all that kind of thing. And I think setting out to find the next great racing driver is quite easy to do, because they're at least out there somewhere, because there will be Grand Prix racing in 25 years' time, and somebody will be the best at that particular time, and probably Fernando Alonso will still be there as well. So that's one thing. But I think it's harder to assume that you'll get a design genius of Newey's type who has that broad view, because now everyone's so much more narrow and specialised, and they're still brilliant people. There will be people with great minds, and there's plenty of them in Formula One, but they don't necessarily have that broader context. They haven't grown up in a time where you can breathe on every single element of a car. No one individual designs a car. And also the way Newey is used is unique. He isn't kind of a 24/7 technical director, if you want to look at it like that. He's able to breathe that creativity into the car. I think maybe the one thing that can be learned from it is that there's a place in teams for people who aren't completely weighed down by the day-to-day grind of just pushing through everything. That's a benefit that we do see some teams trying to push for. But I think it's very, very difficult to find a next Newey, because it could be that the next Newey is a brilliant individual. He's working in a really narrow sphere because of the increased specialisation, because they haven't had the chance to not only design the aero of a car and race engineer Mario Andretti and do all these other things that Adrian Newey has done, which is the foundation of his understanding, and why one of his great skills, I believe, is just looking at any set of regulations and having a great understanding of what the performance sensitivities are and what areas you need to concentrate on. And that's what he's been able to breathe into Red Bull, even though actually the vast majority of the work is all done by all the other technical people in Red Bull. So yeah, certainly everyone's looking for Adrian Newey. They're either looking for the actual Adrian Newey or ideally the next one, but I just don't think it's as simple as that. And I think probably he's from a point in time that has disappeared now with the size of teams. I just can't see somebody coming in, say, as a junior aerodynamicist. That was his first job. He was, as he always puts it, a Fittipaldi junior aerodynamicist, which actually turned out to be senior aerodynamicist because he was the only one in that team. But I don't know about you, Mark. I just think it's very difficult to cultivate that. It's not a question of there not being the odd mind that could do it, but just the opportunity to cultivate that way. I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, and it's purely to do with the size of the teams, as they've exponentially bigger. So they got more departmentalised, and as you say, everybody became much more specialised. And he's from far enough back that Fittipaldi, I think, was like 25 people there or something by the time he joined. So, you know, you're talking of teams of 12 and 1500 people. You can't be on top of everything in that way anymore. So, yeah, it's just the era. I don't think it's to do with the team has been misguided and looking in the wrong places. I think it's just the way the sport has evolved.
He race engineered Damon Hill to a world championship as well, didn't he?
He did, yeah. I mean, he's done everything in that side of things in motorsport, and just an amazing training ground. I mentioned Mario Andretti, IndyCar as well he worked in. So just, yeah, it's just a different time. And I think there's probably quite a few on the technical side who would miss that sort of time. The time where I remember sort of Pat Simmons saying, I think he worked at Royale and he was just told to design a car, and he's like, okay, right, I'll learn how to do that. And that just gives you a different perspective. It's not better or worse necessarily. It gives you a different set of skills and a different perspective, and maybe that creates a mentality or a view where you can feed in a unique way that not many individuals can, which is what Nui certainly seems to be able to do. But yeah, it's just the way the world changes, I guess. Mark, a question now from Chris Brady about the Chinese Grand Prix, who asked, do you think Mercedes' true deficit to other teams was hidden by the safety car's deployment?
No, not really. I think the safety car actually hurt Russell. It helped Hamilton because it sort of brought him back all that deficit that had built up from starting from so far back with the field spread and getting stuck behind slow cars. But it hurt Russell as he was further up and he didn't get the cheap pit stop of Leclerc and Norris. But his pace wasn't so different to the Ferraris just ahead of him. Or Perez has come to that, but Perez had ragged his tyres a bit getting past Leclerc. So, no, the Merc was the fifth fastest car, or maybe equal fourth with Aston. And they'd Lewis had underqualified with his mistake and trying some adventurous stuff with the tyre choices. And George had, you know, used a set of softs in the sprint, so it only had one run in Q3, etc. But I think in the end, George's sixth place in the race was about right. It's about where they're at.
Next up, a question for you, Glenn, from Lee, who says, after the sprint qualifying results, where arguably three of the top-rated drivers on the grid finished in the top three places in the rain, which is always seen as a leveller, does this expose how much the balance of driver versus car has shifted too much towards the cars? Having a decent car has always been the overriding factor, of course, but I can't help feeling that in recent years the driver's ability is held back by the technology, the tyres, etc., and that we need to find a way to keep the cars in check but allow the drivers to go flat out more often and show what they can really do.
I don't think it's really changed. You go back to the early 90s, as we do, and bring back V10s, and you had Ayrton Senna qualifying 2 seconds behind the Williamses because he was at a car disadvantage. The difference was the field was so spread out, he might still be on the second row of the grid, whereas now he'd be last. I'd like to see drivers push flat out more too, or at least I see the appeal of it. But if you have tyres that can be pushed all the time, you might actually see the gaps between some of the teams increase because the faster ones wouldn't have anything limiting their performance. So I'd say that whole debate might be a case of careful what you wish for.
And the next question I'll take from Simon Ems, who says, how do teams decide who goes up on the podium for the team trophy? Is it decided beforehand or does the team principal say your turn as the winner crosses the line? Well, I think the teams that know they're going to be doing the winning are a little bit more formalised now because
Red Bull probably have a rotor by this point, don't they?
Well, exactly, yeah. Yeah, Red Bull certainly. And Mercedes went quite far and wide in their glory years. They made a very real effort to send up people who are in different aspects of the team as well because they're really big. This is a big thing for Toto Wolff of everyone understanding how everything. It's not the people who make the car only have the money to design and make the car because of the money that's brought in commercially, and you need the media side in order to do that. So, and the hospitality side, all of these things. So that's why you see such a wide range. But yeah, normally it's not out to pre-register or anything, as far as I know. It's just you send up whoever you think's appropriate. I think if you had a surprise winner, they might have to toss a coin and just decide who to chuck up there. But yeah, it's a nice way to reward some of the unsung heroes. And of course, Formula One teams are 99% unsung heroes these days because they're so big, but there's only a few that are regularly heard from. So I actually always like it when some of the lesser lights are up there. And even ones with a bit of profile, like in China, it was Paul Monaghan, wasn't it? The chief engineer at Red Bull, who's been integral to their success. He's a recognisable name, but I expect to a lot of people watching, he won't have been familiar. Mm. Yet he's been absolutely critical. And he's not the kind of guy who will be desperately forcing his way up onto the podium, I wouldn't have thought.
Absolutely
but
not.
It's nice to have people like that and then all the other people who play an equally important part who you would never hear of. So I like that aspect of it, actually.
I liked it when Mercedes sent up one of their aerodynamicists, Gilles Peroni, which is the son of the late Didier Peroni.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a lovely little historical link. You know, it's the first time a Peroni had been up there since 1982 when he'd had his career-ending crash. So just little things like that. It just sort of widens the appeal out a little bit and, you know, puts a spotlight on in different places.
Yeah, which is great. And I think it's good teams do that because it'd be a bit dull if it was always the team principal or whatever, or technical director, the people you hear from. Nice to spread it around. Although it'd be nice to see a few other members of other teams being able to go up rather than whatever team's dominating, because we've cycled very well through people at Red Bull and Mercedes over the past decade or so, and there's of course great people in every single team. But yeah, it's up to the team ultimately, and yeah, I like the fact they do that. Now, a question we can all briefly have a crack at to finish off: is the season effectively over already? Glenn, you can answer that first.
Yeah, can't. Well, the championship battle is, because we've already decided which race Max is going to win the title, haven't we? The battle behind Red Bull is interesting. So maybe let's pay Red Bull their prize money, give them all the trophies, and let everyone else get on with it. Because unfortunately, the battle for best of the rest just isn't a narrative you can sell beyond the hardcore audience. I would say that the TV direction is doing quite a good job of not showing too much of Max Verstappen when he's driving around on his own at the front. So we're seeing the battles, which hasn't always been the case in areas of previous dominance. So the race can be quite entertaining, but when it's for the positions that don't matter quite as much, it's just not going to appeal to people in the same way. TV ratings are down every year since 2021. They'll dip again this year. I think we know that already. At what point should F1 be concerned about that? I don't know. And if they don't care, or if they don't think it's important, I'd be curious to know why not. You know, when things are good, you hear about how great the TV ratings are, and they're held up as this like beacon of F1's success. And then when they're not so good, they disappear from the narrative, from the F1 side anyway. So assuming we can't send Red Bull home with all the trophies and championships already, I think they've got to use the sprint weekend format as a chance to inject some variety in. You know, that way you can preserve the integrity of the main qualifying session and the Sunday Grand Prix. That remains untouched. But let's just get braver. Let's get more radical with the sprints. And you never know, we might actually learn something that's valuable for F1 down the line. And if we don't, then we just have something different to talk about, and that's never a bad thing.
What do you think, Mark? Season over?
Yeah, in terms of the championship, of course, yeah, yes. But, you know, the hardcore, I think, you know, I think we do them a disservice thinking that the only interest is who's going to win the championship. You know, you get seasons where it's very obvious who's going to win the championship, and then the interest, then you focus on something else that's interesting. It's got so many dimensions of fascination in this sport that just to be focusing on that one overall, the big prize, I think it does the sport a bit of a disservice. And there's many, many fascinating narratives all the way down through the field, and there always are, and technical and human and, you know, political and all those things. And yes, I obviously prefer it when we got a fierce two or three way battle for the world championship, because it's, as I say, the sport's biggest prize. But I don't think doesn't really bother me that much when it's obvious who's going to win the title, because there's so many other things to look at.
Yeah, there's always something to talk about. And I guess coming back to our early questions about Max Verstappen's brilliance, it's important as well to remember that what Max Verstappen and Red Bull are doing is absolutely brilliant. It's just that exceptional, outstanding, incredible performance can sometimes just seem a bit repetitive. Doesn't make it any less brilliant, but it sometimes takes the sheen off the some of the most eye-catching storylines. But I'm sure there's going to be some twists and turns and surprises this season. There's a lot of races still to go. Well, thanks to the Race Members Club for the questions. Thanks also to Glenn and Mark for your answers. For more of that insight, check out our YouTube channel and our many other podcasts, including the latest addition to our stable with Matt Bishop and Richard Williams, called And Colossally That's History, as well as heading to our website at therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen. We're looking ahead to Miami next with a certain ex-F1 team principal, so stay with us for everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.
The Athletic.